Well, constant listeners, the end is here. We are in our last week that was the year 2022. And this year, when you look back, it certainly brought its positives. It had its setbacks. It brought us some volatility. And it was chock full of surprises. By the way, a belated Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa. I'll be the first one to offer you a Happy New Year. It's also officially winter as of last week, too. So now that we've got all those wishes and recognitions behind us, let's jump to the topic of who, or maybe more appropriately, what we'll dedicate episode 84 to. This one, it was an easy decision for me. We're going to dedicate episode 84 to the NBA Finals matchup in that year, 1984, between the Boston Celtics and the Los Angeles Lakers. This matchup, for me, it represented the start of the golden age of NBA basketball. I was a teenager at the time, a big Celtics fan. I watched every game I could with Larry Bird and Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish, DJ, Danny Ainge. But I also liked the Lakers quite a bit, despite them being the key rival to my favorite Celtics. I mean, how could you not like Showtime with Magic Johnson and Kareem and James Worthy? And don't forget Kurt Rambis with those glasses. Celtics and Lakers, Casey Jones coaching against Pat Riley, East Coast versus West Coast, generational talent against generational talent. It was as good as NBA basketball gets. And by the way, it was just the start of a great run of team rivalries and superstar rivalries and championship rivalries in the NBA. Now, 1984 clearly was Larry Bird's year. He won the league MVP. He was the MVP of those finals against the Lakers. And don't get me wrong, I love Larry Bird, but in many ways, my favorite Celtic of that era was not Bird or even a starter, but instead was the sixth man coming off the bench, and that player was the great Kevin McHale. McHale was amazing underneath the basket and in the paint. He just had an uncanny ability to get that bucket, despite defenders usually being draped all over him. So the finals in 84 went the full seven games. Lakers, they won a game at the Garden. The Celtics stole a game in L.A. at the Forum. Both teams in that series, they won a game at home by a blowout. And the series itself, what I remember about it to this day was how physical it was. Very physical series. All kinds of hard fouls, altercations, and drama. It was intense, to say the least. And to me, that's the way playoff basketball and the NBA Finals are supposed to be. So you had Magic versus Bird. You had McHale versus Worthy. Parrish going up against Kareem. What a rivalry and what an era and what an NBA final back in 1984. By the way, I said that this kicked off the golden era for the NBA. And indeed it did when you think about the lineage that was just started back in 1984. So you had Lakers versus Celtics. Then in a few short years come along the Detroit Pistons and the Bad Boys. Then comes Michael Jordan in the ascendancy of the Chicago Bulls. Great teams, great players, great rivalries in the greatest of pro basketball eras. Thus, episode 84's dedication goes to the 1984 NBA Finals in the era that it started. I want to start making connections to the dot of the 1984 NBA Finals by first acknowledging that the Lakers and the Celtics of that era, they were constructed and built based on the ability of each player and based on the ability to put the best team together on the court to do what? To achieve and win championships. It didn't matter what religion each player was. It didn't matter what their political persuasions were. And it really even didn't matter what they said. What mattered was performance on the court and how one could perform within a team to make the team better. It's a true meritocracy. Very different maybe than what you find in today's NBA, which to me at least seems to be more focused on the branding and sort of highlighting the individual versus the objective of winning a championship in the end. But anyway, the dot I want to connect to is this similarity that you see or you saw with the Lakers and Celtics and how you would hope that our military is making decisions. In other words, as a citizen, right, who relies on government to field a military that maximizes its efficacy, you'd want to see only the best equipment, and the best contractors and the best systems put in place across our armed forces. Unfortunately, that isn't the case when it comes to what's going on with decision making in today's American military. So a rule was recently proposed by the Department of Defense, as well as by NASA, that would require defense contractors in the private sector to disclose to the government what its carbon footprint is, what the plans are to reduce that carbon footprint, and what it sees as climate change financial risks that it faces. So the inference is here, or what? The defense contractor looking to do business with the government, it's going to have to profess its faith to the Church of Climate Change. And then on top of that, it's going to have to make commitments to utilize more wind power, more solar power, more electric batteries across electrification efforts, whether it's with respect to that defense contractor supply chain, manufacturing process, or in the actual military equipment itself. Now, if a contractor doesn't do those things, then it faces certain loss of business with the Department of Defense or NASA. And this, constant listeners, is a massive problem that should be of serious concern to any citizen that is thinking rationally. And that's because all the stuff and all the materials and all the parts for wind and solar and electric batteries, they come from or they're controlled by our adversaries such as China and Russia and others. And this requirement and proposed rule is going to make our military weaker, and it's going to decrease weaponry efficacy. That's a gift to our adversaries. It's a serious risk to our nation. And by the way, that's an order of magnitude greater risk than climate change and Code Red. It's yet another example of a frightening growing trend of where ideology and religion of environmentalism, they're superseding the tangible and the effectiveness of the most fundamental responsibilities that a government has, which of course is providing national defense. It would have spelled loss for the Lakers and Celtics back in 1984, and I fear it's going to spell worse for our military in an increasingly hostile world. I just said that what's going on with the military, with the Church of Climate, it's another example of a growing trend. So let's connect to another dot of another example of that trend, which is that the energy giant BP, which used to be known as British Petroleum, has a proud history of issuing every year its Statistical Review of World Energy. I read that report, and many in the energy industry read that report every single year. And it's an outstanding resource for all things energy related across the globe. Well, the environmental movement has a bit of a problem with this report. What's the problem? The biggest type of problem the environmental movement faces these days, which is what it professes to believe as articles of faith getting destroyed when confronted with the reality of data and science and facts. So the reality and the data that back it up in the BP Statistical Review of World Energy, they show that the much vaunted and highly advertised and heavily promoted energy transition and zero carbon economy, they're not occurring, not by a long shot, and that the world and regions within it are relying, as they should, on things like natural gas more than ever. Well, when the leaders or executives of BP, when they've dove in headfirst into the energy transition and into the zero carbon club, and then they realize the conundrum they're in when they look at the data and facts within their annual energy report that sort of blows up the concept of the club itself, what are they going to do? Well, if they were prior generations of leadership from what was one of the world's preeminent value creation entities, it would accept and embrace the reality and adjust the business strategy accordingly. That's what leaders and innovators and value creators do. But today, the leadership of BP is a very different type or of a very different sort. So what happens in this instance is the exact opposite of what should occur. If BP doesn't like the data or the facts or the answers that its statistical survey is presenting, then instead of changing its business strategy or its direction or what it's saying, the company decides to consider not publishing a report at all. It's not so much a classic case of killing the messenger as it is a situation of killing the data. All too common when it comes to today's players in the energy landscape. I hope that the BP continues to publish this valuable report, but the reality that they are even debating or considering not publishing it, it creates serious concern with me, and it should with you. It's just another symptom of how the energy space is being driven more and more by the mystic and not by the science. It leads to my next connection to make, which is where I really want to invest the remainder of our time with episode 84. As we discussed, the energy space is full of nonsense and fluff these days, and I, along with my colleagues at CNX Resources, we desire to create a forum where we can post facts and reality for all things energy related. And that thought manifested into what we call the Positive Energy Hub. So the web address for this site is positiveenergyhub.com. So give it a look. I think you'll really enjoy it. I think you'll love the content that we're posting on there, all things energy related as time goes on. And about 2 weeks ago, we published on the Positive Energy Hub what we're calling a vision for Appalachia. The title of the presentation is Appalachia First. So it's a slide presentation with some audio to go along with it, but it really lays out a vision that first and foremost is quite different than what you're hearing in the energy space these days. And this vision sort of is approached, or we approach it from two different contrasting perspectives, almost a yin and a yang. So on one side, we're coming from the perspective as a nation and as a world that we're part of, where we're increasingly each day waking up to just some really harsh realities. We're dealing, of course, with energy scarcity. We've got all kinds of issues with inflation driven by energy inflation. We've got concerns about power grids, geopolitics, just a very chaotic world, as I said at the start of episode 84, looking back on 2022. And we're seeing that there's policies when it comes to energy and climate that are just frankly relying too heavily on things like wind and solar and electric vehicles. And it's ignoring some of the realities tied to those types of applications and technologies when it comes to life cycle carbon footprints and the supply chains tied to these different sources that are stretching thousands of miles and have some questionable things going on behind them, the cost associated with them, and of course, you know, what happens when you try to scale some of these technologies in regions like Appalachia. So part of that first perspective that we're approaching this from is understanding that if you don't get the climate policies and energy policies right, you're going to really do damage to things like economic competitiveness, and you're going to do really bad things to the environment when it comes to emissions and CO2, ironically. And you're going to end up, as we've seen, enabling all kinds of bad actors all over the world to do everything from waging war to basically putting them in a position of power where we're going to have to almost ask or beg them for energy resources, which isn't where we need to be. So that sort of serves as the bad news, or the yin side that we're approaching the vision of Appalachia First from. The flip side, the other side we're approaching this from, is the positive or the yang side, which is recognizing that none of this really has to be. There is a much simpler and more logical and better way to go about this. And when you look at that path, Appalachia should be ground zero, should be the launch pad for a much more efficient, a much more environmentally friendly future that's going to be catalyzed by lower carbon intensity natural gas. And it also ties back to the realization that Appalachia as a region should sort of lean on, recognize, rely on the people within the region, because the people within Appalachia have been a solution to a lot of challenges and opportunities for generations, and they will be able to deliver reliable and affordable energy. So looking at the nation's energy resources, and you start to think about where Appalachia sits and what it can do, you can see this region playing the pivotal role to using our energy resources more effectively and to prioritize the improvement of the human condition and the environment and our national standing, our national security, and frankly, you know, sort of the well-being of the world. So if you put, as our logic is going, if you put local communities first in Western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Eastern Ohio, Western Virginia, if you put communities in Appalachia first, it's amazing what will happen sort of subsequent or downstream from that prioritization. And the strategic approaches that we're laying out in our Appalachia First vision, it represents, at least in my mind, a clear roadmap, a very logical roadmap to transform key sectors of our economy and also transform our workforce while we're bringing a lot of those benefits to bear for the nation and the world. From a big picture perspective, that's how we approached the sort of the inspiration and the need for this Appalachia First vision. And I encourage you to give it a detailed look on the Positive Energy Hub site. I think you'll find a lot of it, you know, really of interest, something that probably or may impact how you're thinking or how you're viewing the region, your industry, your business, your career, etc. But it's a document I'm certainly proud of, and I'm really happy to see that CNX Resources put and constructed this type of a vision together. I think it will make a big difference and move the needle. But going to sort of the perspective of what this Appalachia First vision would entail, it goes back to something we spoke about in prior episodes of when looking at business strategies, when looking at community involvement, what some refer to as that stakeholder engagement, right? We're always trying to be tangible. We want to be able to measure the impact that we're having. We want to be impactful. So it's got to be something that moves the needle. It's not just a small impact, but a large impact. And we want to be local. I think, again, if you subsequently think through the progression of prioritization, local first, if you do that, really good things later happen to much wider concentric circles around your local community or your local region. And all of this, I think, reflects the fact that we say this all the time, right? We talk about this across different segments of economies and societies, but we truly are at a critical moment in history. And if we're going to get this right, we're going to need to use innovation. We're going to need to have a vision for the future that is going to be able to contemplate and anticipate changes, and it's going to be able to deliver reliable energy solutions for not just the current state, but for tomorrow, because energy is the foundation of just about everything in an economy and in a society. And when you approach it from that perspective, you suddenly realize that Appalachia, it enjoys a huge competitive advantage to bring a vision like Appalachia First into reality. Appalachia can do this. This is something that's firmly within our control and grasp if we want it to be. And a lot of that competitive advantage that Appalachia enjoys, as I said, it's the people, and it's also that fact that we just sit on top of an abundant, affordable, lower emission, huge source of natural gas. So a couple things. First, the vision that we laid out, it is not meant or designed to be anti-solar or anti-wind. The acknowledgement that those technologies have a role to play in our energy future, it's there. We acknowledge that, of course. But, right, the flip side to that, you got to be realistic about what the roles are going to be of things like wind and solar, where those technologies can be most effectively deployed. They can't be deployed or should not be deployed everywhere. Solar works great in Arizona, right? May not work great in not so sunny Pittsburgh, at least over the course of a winter. You've got to be real and sort of accurate, realistic about the decisions and data around the carbon footprint of these different forms of energy. They do have carbon footprints. We need to calculate them and incorporate them into goals and objectives when it comes to climate change policy. You got to look at their supply chains. They can be quite long, and certain links in those chains can be quite problematic when it comes to human rights and environmental practices, et cetera. And then you got to look at the scalability. Again, wind and solar work wonderfully in certain areas or regions, and they'll work horribly in other regions or locations. So when you start thinking about their scalability across wide swaths of regions or the nation or the world, you've got to be cognizant of that fact. Also, don't interpret a vision that's titled Appalachia First as being something that's anti-free trade or anti-free market. Quite the contrary. The vision we're laying out, it's very pro-growth. It's absolutely pro-market. But most importantly, it's pro-people, as in, you know, pro-people within the Appalachian region. And it also recognizes that we're not going to be able to ever deliver this this better, brighter future by continuing to rely on those same old tired mandates and restrictions that in some instances have been designed actually to hold us back from realizing our full potential. And also, there will be discussion about, well, how does this type of a vision of Appalachia First that we're putting forth, where does it view things like export of natural gas product to other nations internationally through things like liquefied natural gas or LNG? And really, the answer to that comes down to a question of timing and sequencing. Sequencing matters greatly. I think that's a pivotal underlying assumption with our Appalachia First vision. And what I mean by that is you tackle the biggest opportunities and the lowest hanging fruit first. And those reside, those types of market opportunities, whether it be for manufacturing or transportation, all things that natural gas can drive and innovate and spur, those biggest opportunities that are the lowest risk, they sit regionally here first. And to the extent that we seize those, it doesn't only make more sense, you know, economically or rationally or strategically, it also sets us up for bigger successes down the road in future times when it comes to things like exporting more of our product to other nations, et cetera. So it's not anti-export, but it is saying that first things first, there's bigger, better opportunities within our region before we start to pursue and invest and tackle some of these opportunities outside our region and outside our nation, frankly, with international export. The vision itself, it sees a region that's going to drive a nation, which will drive a world where you've got lower cost and abundant and lower emission and efficient Appalachian natural gas, basically turbocharging all different types of sectors of the economy, and that is also improving all kinds of different socioeconomic conditions across the board. So that's a huge underlying sort of drive of this Appalachia First vision. It's also looking at this region being poised to deploy a new wave of technology that's going to enhance societies. And it's going to do that through improved types of technologies and techniques and product derivatives. So that's a big piece of this. And then third, it's a vision that's got the power to transform all kinds of, as I said, just different vertical market integration segments. So whether it's aviation, rail, cargo, plastics, mass transit would be a big beneficiary of this type of a vision. Obviously, the trucking industry and fleet passenger vehicles would be drastically improved and impacted by this. And it would do all that in a way where not just the efficiencies are going up for those different endeavors and industries, and not just the cost being reduced, but also the CO2 emissions and the carbon intensity, both of those being drastically improved. So when you look at it, the vision sort of sees a future where you get these things right and you take advantage of these opportunities that are sitting here right in front of us regionally within Appalachia. It's got a multiplier effect, orders of magnitude, exponential opportunities are sort of unchained moving forward. And in a really short period of time, as I said, this Appalachia First vision, we published it about 2 weeks ago, but in those 2 weeks, a lot of questions that we got inbound once people saw the vision laid out as to, well, what was, you know, the reason as to Appalachia being the center, the focal point of the vision itself. And it really goes back to just a couple of key sort of realities that that reflect that logic. First and foremost, you know, it's all about location, 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 not just in real estate, but also when it comes to energy policy and energy strategy. And if you look at where Appalachia geographically is centered, we've got some really fortuitous positioning that we should be taking advantage of. Half of the United States population sits within a one day's drive of this region. And that's not even counting, right, the access or radius that you can draw around Appalachia as a region when you start to incorporate things like river or rail networks in addition to road networks. And a lot of the infrastructure that we would need to turn this vision loose, whether it's transportation infrastructure or pipeline infrastructure, workforce infrastructure, a lot of it already exists within the region. It goes back to our history and our legacy. So from an incremental basis, sure, we need more investment in infrastructure, but a lot of what we would need to turn the Appalachia First vision loose is already in place. And then, right, when you look at the energy right beneath our feet, and you consider the supply of that energy that could drive the energy needs for Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Ohio and Virginia, you've got decades and decades and decades, well over half a century of supply. So this is something you can make capital investment decisions with respect to when it comes to the vision, and know that the underlying driver of it, which is access to reliable, affordable, abundant energy, that's going to hold true for decades into the future, past the life of your investment, so to speak. It also speaks to a reality when you look at what's happened to energy mix within sort of the energy demand center that that the Appalachian region sits within, and how that's changed over time. So we go into some discussion in a document, you'll see this if you take a look at it on the Positive Energy Hub, that when you look at the PJM power pool, you know, very key, crucial power pool within the United States, but certainly within our regional footprint, and you look at what's happened to it in terms of its makeup from, say, a 2011 time period on through 2021, 10 years, within a decade, you see some pretty interesting takeaways. I mean, the first thing you see is the natural gas's share of that power grid has grown substantially. I think it went from 14% in 2011 all the way up to 38% in 2021. That was not because of government or policy or mandates or prescriptions. It instead was because, of course, of the private sector and innovation. So free market in the region of Appalachia, we've got the wherewithal, the track record, and the history to make a lot of what the Appalachia First envision entails come to life. Another thing you see is that things like coal consumption, right? It's a much smaller piece of the grid in PJM today than it was 10 years ago. went from 47% 10 years ago down to 22% in 2021. Again, a direct correlation or result of what natural gas was able to achieve and earn in the power grid. But then the third piece that really jumps out at you when you look at sort of the PJM power makeup, which goes back to why this Appalachia First vision makes a lot of sense to think of our region first sequentially, is that the renewable share of PJM, solar and wind, was just over 1% of the total mix in 2011. It's just under 4% in 2021. So despite the who knows how many billions of dollars we poured into that that effort and the subsidy and the protected markets and the mandates and the incentives and everything else that the whole of government has thrown at wind and solar, it's still less than 4% of the PJM makeup as a power grid in 2021. So the ability to scale wind and solar to 80, 85, 90% of a power grid like PJM, you've got to be asking some serious questions such as, well, if that's going to happen or achievable, why over the course of 10 years with all that effort behind it cumulatively do we get from just over 1% to just over 4% of the PJM power grid? It's a very relevant question. And the answer, of course, goes back to what I said earlier. Wind and solar work wonderfully in very site-specific applications. Solar in Arizona, wind offshore of New England, great applications. But when you start looking at the ability for them to scale and what that does to sort of reliability and the intermittent nature of them in places like Appalachia, you run into some serious realities. And if you think that that's going, those things are going to represent 80%+ of your grid, I think you got some bad news coming your way. Now, once you see why the Appalachian region is sort of perfectly situated and there's certain realities in terms of what our strengths and what our weaknesses are, strengths being natural gas, weaknesses being able to deploy wind and solar at scale for obvious reasons, now you start to get into some of the obvious follow-on effects and what you should be running down with respect to a vision, right? So utilizing more natural gas in the power sector across the region makes a lot of sense. Utilizing natural gas with innovative technologies to convert it into things like CNG, compressed natural gas, or LNG, liquefied natural gas, in displacing more expensive and more carbon intensive and longer supply chain driven energy sources like gasoline, diesel, aviation fuel, that makes a whole heck of a lot of sense. Looking at natural gas, right, being the bedrock of the grid and benefiting, reaping the rewards of lower CO2 intensity because natural gas has reduced more CO2 off of our grid within the region than wind and solar has over a period of time spanning 15 years. If you look at sort of the 2005-2006 timeframe on out through 2020, actually natural gas is easily been the bigger winner when it comes to CO2 emission reductions net versus wind solar. And then, you know, you get into the carbon footprint side of things tied to supply chains, tied to geology, just makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, to rely on energy mix coming from something right underneath your feet with supply chains that are measured in miles, not thousands of miles, and doing that in a way where you know what the environmental standards are, you know what the labor practices are here. They're all excellent, best in class across the globe versus not even having a clue, but being very worried and concerned about what they might be when it comes to the supply chains of wind and solar and EV type battery applications. And then on top of it, you know, as I said, going to like where did Mother Earth place most of these reserves geologically? We, of course, are sitting on top of what could be one of the largest, if not the largest, gas field in the world. Whereas when it comes to rare earths and some of the metals and other materials, minerals that you need to manufacture things like wind turbines and solar panels and batteries, not a lot of that resides, not just within Appalachia, but it just doesn't reside in the United States itself. So you start to get into all those other ancillary advantages and you start to see, that's when the light bulb starts to go off, pun intended, that some vertical market integration and innovation to start displacing these other energy sources within the Appalachian region first makes clearly the most sense to tackle sequentially, first and foremost. And then once you get that off and running, here comes advanced manufacturing back within the region. Here comes all those other opportunities with respect to exporting our product or products either nationally or internationally, all that other good stuff starts to take off as well. But sequentially, Appalachia first is the way to go. That's the most elegant, efficient path to better GDP growth, better job growth, better economic viability, lower CO2 intensity, right? Better competitiveness, stronger national security standing, all of the above. There's a lot more when it comes to the details of the Appalachia First vision. Again, I encourage you to invest some time, dive a little deeper on the Positive Energy Hub, positiveenergyhub.com. When you get a chance, you'll be glad that you did. But in conclusion, for episode 84, bringing all this home, let's just talk a minute about what the big motivators were for putting this vision together. One, maybe I think the largest in the end, was just a great appreciation and respect for what the potential is of the people of Appalachia. This is very much a people-first vision, people-driven type of a concept. You let the individual in Appalachia loose, you'd be amazed at what they will be able to achieve. So much of this vision is based and steeped in that assumption. There's another one, a second thing that's out there that's driving a lot of this, which is we've seen historically within our region and across our nation that when you have doers that are out there, people creating value, enabling value, serving value, those doers in the economy, if you leave them unhindered to go achieve and do what they're capable of doing, great things happen. That's what created and drove the Industrial Revolution. That's what made the United States the envy of the world. And that is the answer once again to where we want to go into the future. And again, that's an underlying assumption or belief within this Appalachia First vision. And then the last thing is an assumption and a belief that a lot of good things that the regions and economies and societies strive for, educational system, medical prowess, high tech, all those shiny things that everyone aspires to and that have obvious benefits, they all basically depend upon, there's a prerequisite before them, which is having a strong base of wealth creation, legitimate wealth creation, not wealth reshuffling or restructuring, but wealth creation, value creation. And those inherently must come from industries and sectors in our economy, like manufacturing and like energy. So Appalachia First is a vision, you know, puts those industries first and says, if we get those right within the region of Appalachia, the people in the region, right, the doers in the region, and these industries within the region are going to lead to really good things for region, nation, and world. Pretty simple. I appreciate your time and listening in on episode 84. Happy New Year. Next time we talk with episode 85, it's going to be 2023. Happy New Year, everybody.